The 6th of February, 1893. It is almost 11 a.m. The ship SS Carthage, after its three-week-long voyage from England, has just arrived in Bombay. Amongst the passengers is a young man. There are no friends or relatives to receive him. There is instead the presence of Mother India herself, for she has long been awaiting the return of this son who will strive for her liberty and work to rejuvenate her spirit, is none other than the future Sri Aurobindo. On his return to India on that very date, over 100 years ago, few would have foreseen for the young Aurobindo Ghosh the role of a fervent Indian nationalist, for he knew little of his own country then. He had been away in England since the age of 7, absorbed in the study of Western thought, literature and culture. He had studied the classics, performing brilliantly at his examinations at Cambridge, had mastered Greek, Latin, English and French, and also gained familiarity with some other continental languages. Yet, having been brought up in an ambience totally devoid of any Indian influence, he could not even speak his own mother tongue, Bengali, fluently.
Being in England towards the end of the 19th century, that is to say in the heyday of colonial empires, he had witnessed the rising euphoria brought about by materialistic and industrial growth and progress. He had seen the vehement logic of science and reason sweep all aside in its triumphant march. Yet India had beckoned the young Aurobindo to another future. His Western upbringing seemed but a necessary first step in his life, as though destiny had conspired to bring him up away from all influence of family, nation and tradition as a free genius. This freedom would later help him to rediscover and reinterpret the ancient truths of India, not only for herself, but for humanity as a whole. The moment Sri Aurobindo, at the age of 21, set foot on the Indian soil at Apollo Bandar in Bombay, India bestowed on him her priceless gift, a mystic experience. A vast peace and calm descended on Sri Aurobindo to remain with him for months afterwards. With this experience, India herself had initiated him into her life. He would now begin his exploration of India and of the East.
And indeed, the enthusiasm with which Sri Aurobindo had read Homer, Virgil and Dante, he now put in the reading of the Mahabharata, Ramayana, Kalidas and the sacred scriptures. Master of several Occidental languages, he now learned Bengali, Sanskrit, Hindustani, Marathi and Gujarati, almost all by himself. These were years of self-culture and literary activity. Sri Aurobindo sought passionately to understand his country's ethos. The spirit of India was gradually animating him. Yet the country was still in chains. Her freedom now became his overwhelming concern. The moderate leadership, then in control of the nationalist movement, was still in a prayer and petition stage. Sri Aurobindo gave a new impetus to the movement on his very entry into the political scene. His action and direct participation in the freedom struggle lasted for a brief period, from 1902 to 1910. But these years heralded a new stage in the struggle. The goal of Swaraj, or complete independence, was planted firmly for the first time in the national consciousness. Non-cooperation, passive resistance, Swadeshi, boycott, and national education were introduced as effective means to combat the British. With his fiery articles in the columns of the daily Vande Mataram, Sri Aurobindo kindled fire in the hearts of young Indians. He conjured the country's basic reality as a goddess, a divine mother. In fact, the greatest thing done in those years was the creation of a new spirit in the country. In the enthusiasm that swept, surging everywhere with the cry of Bande Mataram, ringing on all sides, men felt it glorious to be alive and dare and act together and hope. And Sri Aurobindo embodied this hope, this glorious heroism. In fact, it soon earned him a formidable reputation in the British mind. The Viceroy of India, Lord Minto himself, declared that Sri Aurobindo was certainly the most dangerous man we now have to reckon with.
It was to this young leader, with the intent, dark eyes, and immovable gravity, who preached nationalism as a religion, that the poet Rabindranath Tagore paid tribute in his now famous lines.
Rabindranath, O Aurobindo, bows to thee. O friend, my country's friend, O voice incarnate, free of India's soul, the fiery messenger that with the lamp of God hath come. Rabindranath, O Aurobindo, bows to thee.
Even as Sri Aurobindo was involved in the turmoil and increasing ardor of the freedom struggle, another future was preparing itself for him. The divine was at work, unseen within. Arrested and kept in the Alipore jail for a year, Sri Aurobindo had the experience of the presence of Vasudeva everywhere.
I looked at the jail that secluded me from men, and it was no longer by its high walls that I was imprisoned. No, it was Vasudeva who surrounded me. I lay on the coarse blankets that were given me for a couch, and felt the arms of Sri Krishna around me, the arms of my friend and lover.
Om Lokanatham Trilokesham Kaustubha Bharanam Harim
Shri Krishna
Sharanam Mama Etam Varam Neela Varanam Shri Vatsa Pada Bhushitam
Shri Krishna Sharanam Mama
Vasudevam Rishikesham Madhavam Madhusudanam
This coming from one who had said earlier,
the agnostic was in me, the atheist was in me, the skeptic was in me, and I was not absolutely sure that there was a God at all.
The divine was leading Sri Aurobindo's destiny. Inspired, his defending lawyer C.R. Das concluded his arguments in court with these prophetic words.
My appeal to you is this, that long after this controversy is hushed in silence, long after this turmoil, this agitation ceases, long after he is dead and gone, he will be looked upon as the poet of patriotism, as the prophet of nationalism, and the lover of humanity. Long after he is dead and gone, his words will be echoed and re-echoed not only in India, but across distant seas and lands. Therefore I say that the man in his position is not only standing before the bar of this court, but before the bar of the High Court of History.
Sri Aurobindo was acquitted. Then one day, even as his arrest seemed imminent a second time, he received an Adesh, an inner command that directed him to go first to the French settlement of Chandernagore and then to the capital of French India, Pondicherry. Sri Aurobindo's active work in the political field had come to an end. The Indian people had awakened to the call of the motherland and the country's freedom was assured. Now, at Pondicherry, began the most important chapter of Sri Aurobindo's life, where he gave himself entirely to the pursuit of yoga.
Why this moving away from center stage? Why this sudden choice of a different path? It cannot be for an individual enlightenment alone that Sri Aurobindo sailed for Pondicherry. The man who had absorbed the dynamism and vitality of the West, who had taken the lead in the freedom struggle and proposed for India total independence, urged Indians into action with his fiery articles, encouraged revolt and rebellion at a time when the moderates advocated compromise, organized underground revolutions against the British rule. This man of action, who had found in the Gita a source of inspiration and who had directed a journal called Karma Yogin, could not be a man who had turned to yoga to escape from the world's turmoil and suffering. If he had taken it up, it must have been because he had found in it an instrument of action and change. As Sri Aurobindo said himself while beginning yoga in Baroda,
"I thought that a yoga which required me to give up the world was not for me. I had to liberate my country. I took to it seriously when I learnt that the same tapasya which one does to get away from the world can be turned to action. I learnt that yoga gives power, and I thought, why should I not get the power and use it to liberate my country?"
This would remain the thrust of Sri Aurobindo's yoga, a life embracing spirituality characterized by the same dynamism that defined his political ideals. But why, we may ask, the need of action through yoga? How is it relevant today? Over 100 years have passed since Sri Aurobindo left the Indian political scene. We have come a long way. We have gained our independence, and in fact, much of the world is now politically free. In these years, we have also witnessed many social, economic and scientific revolutions. Today, in the new technological age, nations are vying with one another to be richer, stronger, to be ahead in everything. Yet, despite appearances, how far have we really changed? Beneath the veneer of modernity, haven't we remained much as we were before? Isn't the primitive man still alive in us?
Time and again, when we seem well on the road to progress, we are taken aback by the sudden emergence of forces that baffle our minds with their violence. They trigger off war and confrontation between nations, peoples and communities. Our peace efforts themselves seem to aim not so much at establishing peace on earth as at averting war. Why these problems? Are we still at a level of development that does not give us either the vision or the power to bring about a real, a radical change? History is witness to the rise and fall of innumerable ideas, ideologies, institutions and systems. How often old systems are brought down and new ones erected in their place. Yet, each system, each solution that our mind proposes seems inevitably to bring in its wake a plethora of new difficulties. Why these shortcomings? According to Sri Aurobindo,
"Mind has not been able to change human nature radically. You can go on changing human institutions infinitely, and yet the imperfection will break through all your institutions. It must be a power that can not only resist, but overcome that downward pull.
The solution would then lie in finding that other power, more effective than mind. And Sri Aurobindo assures us that we can find it if only we make the effort, for its secret lies in ourselves. Instead of incessantly modifying outer institutions, it is time perhaps to effectuate a radical change within. Maybe our inner self needs to be transformed before we attempt to transform the outer world. As Sri Aurobindo says in his epic poem, Savitri,
"We may find, when all the rest has failed, hid in ourselves, the key of perfect change."
The endeavor to discover and develop these inner potentialities is the aim of yoga. In Sri Aurobindo's own words, "Yoga is the art of conscious self-finding." This self-finding is not merely a psychological introspection. It is not only the refining of our sensibilities, the strengthening of our moral values. It is a going beyond the mind and deep within to a new state of awareness, a new mode of conscious existence.
It is for the work of establishing this profound spiritual awakening in man that Sri Aurobindo spent the last 40 years of his life in Pondicherry pursuing his sadhana. How can one describe its far-reaching goals? It seeks to transform human life on earth, to herald a new future for man by leading him to the next stage in evolution. It seeks to bring forth the light of which our highest ideals of truth, beauty and goodness are mere reflections. And Sri Aurobindo affirms that India has a leading part to play in this new endeavor. Isn't this the land which, through the ages, from the Vedas to Vivekananda, has sought to find and express a deeper vision and truth? Sri Aurobindo enables us to relate that vision and truth to today's age. He makes us realize that a spiritual life is not an escape from the world, but an essential answer to its needs. It does not negate material development. It rather raises up and perfects every aspect of human life. The field of action is still the earth. And Sri Aurobindo in his books exemplifies this multi-dimensional interest and concern for all human activities, from the political and social to poetry and philosophy.
Just as a revolutionary, Sri Aurobindo had shaken his countrymen from their slumber, he now urges us to awaken and act for the larger progress and future of humanity. For haven't we languished too long with our imperfections, lived satisfied with our mediocrity?
Those who are poor, ignorant, ill-born or ill-bred are not the common herd. The common herd are all who are satisfied with pettiness and an average humanity.
Sri Aurobindo invites us then to discover with him our unknown inner landscape, to surpass ourselves. He calls us to a new adventure.
With wind and the weather beating round me, up to the hill and the moorland I go. Who will come with me? Who will climb with me? Wade through the brook and tramp through the snow? Not in the pettiest circle of cities, cramped by your doors and your walls I dwell. Over me, God is blue in the welkin. Against me the wind and the storm rebel. I sport with solitude here in my regions. Of misadventure have made me a friend. Who would live largely? Who would live freely? Here to the wind-swept uplands ascend. I am the lord of tempest and mountain. I am the spirit of freedom and pride. Stark must he be, and a kinsman to danger, who shares my kingdom and walks at my side.
Will we accept his invitation?